Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. You're listening to a story from The Essential Sosunko, collected portraits and tales of a bygone chess era by Grandmaster Genna Sosunko. Since the 1980s, he has written extensively for New in Chess magazine. Sosunko's chess writings, rather than being technical, chronicle the lives of the former and current top players with whom he has crossed paths. Today's episode is the first in a two-part story about Mikhail Botvinnik. Born in Kuokkala on August 17, 1911, Botvinnik became the sixth world chess champion in 1948. His reign, interrupted twice by Smyslov and Tal respectively, lasted until 1963. Botvinnik had a profound influence on many aspects of chess, for example, in his contribution to the importance of analysis. Enjoy the stories in today's reading, narrated by professional voice actor Nick Murphy, from The Essential Sosunko, Chapter 4, Mikhail Botvinnik.
Mikhail Botvinnik, 1911 to 1995, A Journey to Immortality. I played my only game with Botvinnik in the spring of 1989. He was in Holland to buy a new, stronger computer that he needed for his work, and I was with him all the time. On one of the days, Botvinnik was asked to make an appearance at the closing ceremony of the Dutch Junior Championship in Hilversum. There were, of course, both photographers and television cameras. At some point, the director of the television broadcast asked, "If Mr. Botvinnik has no objection, we would like to film him during a game." "Well, I haven't played for a long time." I urged him, "They are very insistent, Mikhail Moiseevich. You yourself know television. They won't leave you in peace." "Well, if that's the case..." We set up the pieces. I got white.
Let's go," the director ordered.
I decided not to try anything original and advanced my queen's pawn. There was a whirring of the TV camera, and somewhere the voices of children. Botvinnik did not reply for some time, and I looked inquiringly at him. His entire appearance had changed. He had drawn himself erect and stiffened on his chair. Finally, looking at the board, he adjusted his glasses and his tie and made his reply. Unfortunately, neither then, in the bustle of the moment, nor later, in the drag of daily life, did I record the game, although I remember its course very well. He played the Dutch, an old-fashioned stonewall, with the bishop on e7. I made all the well-known moves, and Botvinnik replied unhurriedly, always stopping to think. But after about 15 moves, for some strange reason, my position had lost its flexibility. The general plan had been lost. I stood rather worse. "Is that enough?" I asked the director.
"More than enough."
Botvinnik was thinking over his move. "Mikhail Moiseevich, he says that he has taken enough film." Botvinnik continued looking at the board. Finally, he raised his head, not blinking. He looked harshly at me with his blue, already discoloured eyes, and their astigmatically arranged pupils, which had also looked into the eyes of Lasker, Capablanca, and Aliekin. And he knew well the evaluation of the position on the board, and he knew that I also knew.
"He says, Mikhail Moiseevich, that it has all turned out well."
Something melted in his face, and turning to the director, he said with a slight bow in perfect Dutch,
"My pleasure, sir. At your service."
As a frequent visitor to Holland, the first time in 1938, he knew a few expressions in Dutch, although both his English and his German were rather poor. I made the acquaintance of Mikhail Moiseevich Botvinnik in the spring of 1988, when he came at the invitation of Bessel Kok to one of the first Swift tournaments in Brussels. Henceforth, we met regularly during his frequent visits to Amsterdam or Brussels, or in Moscow, the last time during the Olympiad in December 1994, 6 months before his death.
I now regret that I did not have the foresight of an Ekerman and did not write down all my conversations with Botvinnik. But much is still fresh in my memory, and fortunately I recorded a good deal on tape. On one of his first visits to Amsterdam, when he was a guest at someone's house, a woman, a Muscovite, already somewhere in her mid-40s, on seeing before her the living Botvinnik, introduced herself in her confusion as Olya.
"Well, if you are Olya, then I am Misha," Botvinnik replied, striking the same note.
A few minutes later, I said jokingly to him, "Well, Misha, time to go, it's getting late." The following day, he presented me with one of his books, with an inscription made with a shaky but clear hand. "To Genna Sosonko, on his birthday, from Misha Botvinnik, Amsterdam, 18/5/1989. That is how we addressed each other for a few days, but the joke did not grow into a habit, and we soon reverted to Mikhail Moseyevich and Gennady Borisovich. Only on a few occasions did he return to Genna when he wanted to say something confidential or special. I used to call him Misha when parting, and when I tried, always unsuccessfully, to remove the coating of many Soviet decades, or to get behind his established concepts to get something. When saying goodbye to him during his last visit to Tilburg in September 1994, something faltered in the old man, in his intonation, in his eyes. After the usual words, I said, bending down very close, "Misha, you must hold on, hold on." And then, almost tactlessly, "Well, I don't know when we will see each other again," striking a philosophical chord. He interrupted with a severe, "And what do you mean? You, Genna, can perhaps come to Moscow." "All right," I said, "maybe you're right. Once again, all the best." In 1988, I spent 10 days in a row with him, when I went to Moscow with the young Chiron Piquet for some training sessions with the Patriarch. I still can see the Grandmaster Room in the Central Chess Club on Gogolevsky Boulevard. 15-year-old Alexei Shirov, with his trainer Vladimir Bagirov, who also attended the lessons, and Mikhail Moseyevich himself, who always thought a little before asking a question or making a comment. One thing that sticks in my memory was the essential rule, for some reason formulated by him almost religiously, to make the first 15 moves in a game within half an hour, in order to avoid time trouble. A rule which, for a reason unknown to me, he always referred to as the Chinese rule. I also remember him stop during analysis, and a question to Piquet. "I have the impression that you do not know my game with Uraev from the championship of the Union of Metalworkers in 1927. I objected. "But Mikhail Moseyevich, how on earth could Chiron know your game with Uraev from the championship of the Union of Metalworkers of 1927? "No, you ask him nevertheless, translate." It was there that I realized that his single-minded manner of thinking, which did not know any doubts and was in many respects dogmatic, together with his very high class, was ideal for lessons with young players. And as a teacher, he was, of course, excellent. It was a hot July month, and in a neighbouring room, playing endless training games, was a very small, thin lad, to whom Botvinnik advised that we pay particular attention. His name was Volodya Kramnik. On his last visit to Holland, where he gave a lecture to students at the economics faculty in Tilburg, we had lengthy talks, and not only about chess. I would even say not so much about chess, as about his parents, his wife, books and music, Stalin and Molotov, always nevertheless returning to chess. He spoke in a precise, concise language, often banal in its simplicity, slightly guttural, and of course with his own Botvinnik interpretation and way of seeing events and facts.
My father came from Belarus, from the village of Kudryshino, which is 25 kilometers from Minsk, not far from the little town of Ostrosytsky. His father, my grandfather, was a tenant farmer. In general, it was rare for a Jew to work in agriculture, but that's how it was. All his sons, and he had five, including my father, worked for him. My father was born in 1878. He possessed enormous physical strength. He would seize by the horns a bull out of a herd and throw it onto the ground. He had a severe character, and if something seemed just to him, he would stand up for it to the end. Yes, probably. Probably both my constitution and my character traits come from him. He spoke Russian without any accent, and he wrote very well. I remember that he had beautiful handwriting. Of course, he also spoke Yiddish. I don't know if he went to a Jewish school, but at home we were forbidden to talk in Yiddish, only in Russian. At the age of 25, he left for Minsk. Then the revolution of 1905 began, and he worked in an underground press. There, on account of poisoning, he lost his teeth, and he decided to become a dental mechanic. Two of his brothers left for America back in the last century, and his sister, Raisa, my aunt, also went there, but she left later in 1914. I remember how she came to say goodbye to us in St. Petersburg. I was very small, and I was standing up in my cot, waving a wooden sabre, and I hit my Aunt Raisa on the head with it when she came up to me. After my victory in Nottingham, she sent me a congratulatory postcard from America. I, of course, did not reply. At that time, this was terribly dangerous. It was no accident that she sent the congratulations not in a letter but on a postcard, so that everyone could see that there were no secrets. My father, however, travelled to Berlin to study with a dental mechanic. But he did not like the Germans, and so he came to St. Petersburg. He became a pupil to the dental mechanic Vasily Efremov. I saw him at my father's funeral, a small man with an enormous grey beard. My father studied with him and received his diploma and the right to live in St. Petersburg. At first, he rented a flat on Pushkin Street, and there he met my mother, Serafima Samolovna Rabinovich. She was a dentist. She also had a very interesting life. My mother was 2 years older than my father. She originated from Krislavka, Vitebsk province in Belarus. My grandfather on my mother's side was a private charge d'affaires for Baron Kleipel. He had a large house on the banks of the Dvina. I remember this house from a photograph. It was burnt down during the war. My mother told me that when the oldest son of my grandfather Isaac, in honour of whom my older brother, who was killed in the war, was named, arrived in Krislavka, they would spend all night long playing chess, but at what standard they played is not known. Then, in Dvinsk, my mother received her dentist's diploma. She also participated in the 1905 revolution and was even in the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, but she belonged to the Mensheviks. Then she came to St. Petersburg and worked in the dispensary at the Obukhov factory. At the time, a little steam train used to run there from the Nikolaev station. I remember it well. She used to travel on it and place orders with the dental mechanic on Pushkin Street. That was how she met my father. They got married. She left the factory and went to live at his place. It was there that my elder brother Isaac was born. My father was a very good mechanic. Things took a turn for the better, and we moved to the Nevsky Prospect, where we lived in the courtyard of Block 88. We had a large, sunny flat of 7 rooms on the 3rd floor. There was a lift, and on the ground floor there was a doorkeeper. There was a cook and a maid, and one time my brother and I even had a nursery governess. Then came 1917, the February Revolution. I was 6 years old, and I remember it very well. When there was shooting on the street, Mother would put us behind a wardrobe. We were, after all, living on the Nevsky in the very centre of the city. In 1920, my father was attracted by another woman, and he left us. He got married to a noble woman. He had another family, two daughters. With one of them, who is 10 years younger than me, I now have close relations. I was taught chess by my friend, Leonya Baskin. I was 12 years old. He lived in the next courtyard of the same block on the Nevsky. The parents of this Leonya had a small grocery shop, also on the Nevsky. Do you remember that block where the Kronika cinema is now? Altogether, I have been only twice to a synagogue. The first time was with Leonya and his parents. There was some Jewish festival, and they took me with them. On Troitsky Street, there was a large choral synagogue, but I didn't like it there. In general, although I saw my maternal grandfather wearing a skull cap, my father and mother were internationalists. The second time was in 1964, after the Olympiad in Israel, when we had an excursion to Jerusalem. I made an appearance at a kibbutz not far from the Lebanese border. There I was asked about my Jewishness. I replied, "My situation is complicated, because by blood I am Jewish, by culture Russian, and by education Soviet." There was no further questions. Among the people, you know, in the 20s and 30s, there was no anti-Semitism. This came later, from above. Well, of course, there was a veiled intrigue when I played against Smyslov, Jew against Russian. There were no anti-Semitic exclamations from the audience. My hearing is very good. But there were telephone calls, especially during the return match. And there was anti-Semitic abuse. That did happen. Of course, I phoned the militia from the neighbours and the calls ceased.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. With the DGT electronic chessboard, millions of chess lovers can follow chess tournaments live. At-home chess fans use the boards to play online or play against chess computers with the same boards that top players use in tournaments all over the world. Play like a pro with a DGT board.
In general, after 1920, we were very poor. My mother was ill, and my father gave us 120 rubles a month, which was a very, very modest amount. No, my father and mother no longer saw each other, although they maintained relations. My mother was frequently ill, and when she was in hospital, my brother did the housework. When I became a student in 1928, he used to give me a ruble a day for travelling to the institute. Dinner and supper. I went to school on Finnish Lane by the Finland station, and I walked there along Liteyny Prospect, right across the city. There were some excellent teachers, and I owe much to the school. At the age of 9, I read nearly all of the Russian literature, the classics. Books were very cheap. I read Pushkin, Lermontov, Gogol, Turgenev, and later Tolstoy, War and Peace. Tolstoy put everything into this, but Anna Karenina and the rest are weaker. But above them all is Pushkin, of course. I don't know when he will be surpassed, if ever. After all, he was so full of life, so optimistic and so laconic. He never wrote anything uninteresting or verbose, whereas other writers did. Of the modern writers, I liked Shostakovich. I met him in 1933, when he came to the last round of the USSR championship. He looked very sad. He said something surprising to me.
"You will achieve a great deal, and not only in chess."
He took a liking to me. I also rate Yevgeny Schwartz very highly. Have I read Solzhenitsyn? I read One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and Matronya's Home and took a dislike to him. Ivan Denisovich is plagiarism. He has taken it all from Tolstoy, from War and Peace. It is Platon Karatayev, transformed to modern times. It is cleverly written, of course, but you also have to give some content. While Matronya's home is an appeal to the reactionary peasant past of Russia. I haven't read anything more of him. Everything was clear to me. As for music, here two factors played a part. Firstly, music lessons at school, and secondly, my wife. At school, there were no singing lessons such as there are now. There were lessons of listening to music, and either the teacher herself played, or else she invited students from the conservatory. We learned to listen to and to understand music. Therefore, I knew Russian and international music quite well. Gayan Davidovna and I used to go to the opera, although rarely, and much more often to the ballet. I met my wife on May the 2nd, 1934. I remember that day very well. My wife's maiden name was Ananova. She was 100% Armenian, but was born in St. Petersburg. She was 3 years younger than me. Her father was from the Rostov region, and her mother was from Aisk. In the family, they spoke only Russian, although when the parents wanted the children not to understand, they spoke to each other in Armenian. She was amazingly friendly, kind, and very religious. This faith was a great support to her. Slava Rogozin remarked about her, "Gnochka is an obliging person." Capablanca said about her, "Et bonne et belle." Part of my success belongs to her, of course. In everything that I did, she supported me. By profession, she was a ballerina. She studied with the famous Vaganova. She danced first in the Mariinsky, the Kirov Theatre, then after the war in the Bolshoi. In total, she was a dancer for 24 years, right up to 1956. In the Bolshoi, she performed in figure dances, but also sometimes in individual parts, for example, in the Gypsy Dance in La Traviata, or in Gaïn, where she danced in a four. She had a phenomenal memory. After all, there were no videos, but she remembered nearly all the productions. I always went, of course, when she was dancing. Well, then her daughter, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. She devoted all her life to them, and she also looked after my mother. Now, my great-granddaughter Mashenka, she is 5 and is very much like her, just as friendly and likeable, and she calls me Grandad Mish, and sociable too, whereas Gayan Davidovna was always a little sad. Talking about music, I remember how, in the autumn of 1934, I heard Koslovsky in Yevgeny Onyegin. He was a fantastic singer with a brilliant voice, and I rate him higher than the Italians. The following year, I heard him in Rigoletto. At that time, I often went to the theatre. Leningrad was simply staggered by my successes, and I had a free pass to the director's box in all the theatres. No, I didn't know Shostakovich, but I was friendly with Sergei Sergeyevich Prokofiev, and also with the conductor Kaikin. We were both elected deputies to the Leningrad City Council, and it was incredibly tedious, so we sat next to each other and chatted about this and that. Later, I also used to see him in Moscow. I met Prokofiev in Moscow during the third international tournament. He liked chess very much. He played himself, and he was a friend of Capablanca. I was then half a point behind Capa, after losing to him in a completely won position. Do you remember this game? I was playing very well, and then, at the end of the tournament, I had black against Levenfish, whereas Capa had white against Eliscasis. Levenfish spread a provocative rumour that he was being forced to lose to me, and he informed Capablanca of this. Prokofiev also heard about this. He was a hot-tempered person, and he severed all relations with me. Capa won easily against Eliscasis, while I gained an advantage in the dragon and even won a pawn, but because of the opposite-coloured bishops, it ended in a draw. Prokofiev understood everything and when Kappa and I shared first place in Nottingham, he sent congratulatory telegrams to us both. Then we were friends. But in the 1940 championship, he nevertheless supported Keres and not me. Do I like his music? I remember back in school his piece Despair being played, and I liked it very much. When he died, I was asked to write about him. The musical experts were very surprised, since they had never heard of this piece. This is a very strong work, but in general his music was somehow artificial. In his memoirs he states that you must write music in a way that has not been done before you. But what did Kappa teach? That you should always play by position. But of course Prokofiev has some very strong works. Now Shostakovich is somehow closer to me. His music is more lively, mischievous. Was Prokofiev a strong player? No. The King's Gambit, Sacrifices, Everything Forward. And so Oistrakh easily won against him when they played a match in 1937. Oistrakh had a waiting style. The main thing was not to make any mistakes. He and I were also very friendly. But in general, I prefer the piano. There you can express more. Did I record my very first games? Yes, of course, in that little notebook, which I think is now with Baturinsky. I also recorded some simultaneous games by Lasker, and the games from the second championship of my school, where I took first place. All the games are recorded, with notes to nearly all of them. My parents were categorically against me playing chess. I remember walking with my father along Vladimir Prospect, past the gambling club, where on the top floor the Petrograd Chess Assembly occupied two rooms, and saying to him, "Daddy, look, that's where I play." He was very opposed to the fact that I played chess. He was terribly worried that I would pass through all the rooms of this gambling den. He thought that it would drag me down. But gambling did not interest me at all. I was aiming for the top floor, where I could play chess. Even when successes came and my name appeared in the papers, there was no great enthusiasm. When, in 1926, I needed to travel for the first time to play in Stockholm, my mother rushed to the school and spoke to the teacher of our class, and he said, ironically to her, "In order to see the world at such an age, one can even miss 10 days in school." Even before this, she secretly complained to the director of the school about my fascination. He said to her, "Your son is a bookworm. Leave him in peace." Later, of course, they reconciled themselves to it. They had been against it for the reason that chess was not a profession, but I could not avoid playing. The following year, in a non-category tournament, I already played well. No, I didn't have any trainer. I learned everything from books, and I analysed a lot myself. At that time, everyone in Leningrad was a pupil of Romanovsky, but I did not go to that club, for which Romanovsky hated me. In general, relations with him were difficult, but of course, outwardly this did not show. We greeted each other and observed all the normal decencies. The first with whom I severed all contact was Bronstein. After our match, he behaved outrageously. In the auditorium, directly opposite the stage, was the box of the KGB, where all his supporters from his Dynamo Club were sitting. So when he sacrificed something or won a pawn, they all applauded. He would make a move and quickly go behind the stage. Then he would suddenly dart out and disappear again. In the auditorium, there was laughter, and this hindered my playing. And regarding the fact that he claimed that during the 23rd game he was thinking more about the fate of his father, he was prompted to say this by Weinstein, his evil genius. Weinstein was a dreadful man, simply dreadful. He used all his connections to hinder my discussions with Aliekhin. During the war, he campaigned for Aliekhine to be declared a criminal and for him to be deprived of his title of world champion. He put pressure on me to be the initiator of this. Clearly, this was the simplest, that Aliekhine would altogether not play the match. After my match with Bronstein, although he and I continued to say hello, he ceased to exist for me. During the last few years, I have begun to relate normally to him, but he still hates me. With Levenfish, too, I had difficult relations. In general, he was a very intelligent man. Before the revolution, he studied at a technological institute in Petersburg. As a chess player, he was very talented. But he did not devote all his time to chess, although he possessed a great knowledge of the game. He was always a lone wolf. In 1917, he was already grown up, and I was still a child. But no, I don't think, as you say, that we perceived in different ways what was happening. I do not think that he was anti-Soviet. In the end, he did not live so badly in the Soviet Union. As for the fact that he could not travel abroad, I'm not sure that it was so important. Likewise, I remember that I talked to Gulko and his wife when they applied for a visa in 1979, and I told them that I could also have remained in Stockholm in 1926, but that I didn't, and that it did not turn out badly. Romanovsky was not anti-Soviet either, whereas Bagatrichuk hated Soviet power. No, I have not read his book, but I know him well. He was talented. He understood positions well, calculated well, and used Lasker's principle. If you stand worse, you are not yet lost. But as a person, he was unscrupulous. I lost a game to him in 1927, and later two more. But what can you do? There was a forestry worker in Siberia called Ismailov, and I also lost two games against him, one in Odessa in 1929, and the other in the semi-final in 1931, so that I only just got into the final. Well, with Petrosian, I also had no relations after he had behaved quite improperly during our match. We had to sign the regulations for the match, and he did not like some trifling point, I don't remember which, and he would not sign. I said, very well, I'll phone Rogard. Footnote, Volker Rogard, 1899 to 1973, president of FIDE from 1949 to 1970, end footnote. They told me in the Federation to wait a couple of days. Petrosian agreed. Then he again raised his objections, and this occurred several times. It was clear that they had decided to fray my nerves. When Petrosian climbed the stairs at the Estrada Theatre, the Armenians in front of him scattered sacred earth from Ekmeadzin. Well, what a way to go on! But he regarded this as being right and proper. If in front of me they had scattered sacred earth from Jerusalem, what would I have done? Sweep it up, and I can walk on, I would have said. With Smyslov I also had strained relations, but nothing comparable. Now Vasily Vasilevich and I get on normally. With Ervid, too, there were strained relations when we were rivals. For example, in Groningen in 1946, when it was clear that, if he were to win this tournament, there would be no match tournament in 1948. But later, when the competitive element was no longer there, we were the best of friends.
This was a story from the book The Essential Sosunko. It is available at newinchess.com. A new podcast will be available every Friday on Spotify and Apple. Check out newinchess.com/podcast.